Must, and boy, did he emphasize that word. You must have faith in these things, and he told me what they were. And I couldn't have any faith in those things. You know why? Because I didn't even believe them. So thank God for the second step for we to come to believe. Later on, I get married to Phyllis. And after a while, I go to the psychiatrist this time and paid him $75 an hour. And he said, Mr. McCoy. Now, for 75 bucks an hour, they call you Mr. He said, Mr. McCoy, what seems to be your problem? Well, I don't know what the problem is. So I tell him what I think it is, and it's her and her. And if you live with them two, babe, you drink too, I said. So I didn't know what the problem is. Now I know. I have done this inventory process, and now I can see what my problem is, mostly. And now I'm going to take it to another human being to help see him, let him help me see things that I couldn't see. Because prior to AA, I didn't know nothing about any of this stuff. You know, a lot of people in the treatment facilities, especially, would have us believe that we're into denial. I have never been into denial. I have been into ignorance.
That's right.
I did not know that I did not know, you see. All right, now when we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time moving right along. And I called my sponsor at that time, Franklin. I said, Franklin, can I come over and do my inventory? And he said, sure, I'm waiting for you. So I went over there to see Franklin, which is about an eight-hour drive from my house, and sat down that Friday evening, and I said, well, I'm here to do my fifth step. And he said, yeah, I know you are, and I'm waiting for you, and I'm glad you're here. And he said, well, let's you and I do the third step prayer together. So that's what we did, to start out and ask God to be here with us in this thing, and that was the kind of sponsor that I had. And he said, we have a written inventory and prepared for a long talk. We explained to our partner what we're about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize he will engage upon a life and death errand. Most people approached in this way would be glad to help. They would be honored by our confidence, and certainly Franklin was. And I spent that evening and the next day and the Sunday morning, we were talking about me and him and back and forth. He helped me see things that I couldn't see, explained a lot of things because he'd been AA a long time, explained a lot of things and helped me see things I couldn't see. And said we would pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once having taken this step with holding nothing, we are delighted. And here's some more promises, by the way. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but we now begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel that we're on a broad highway walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. I don't know about you, but I know about me, and for many, 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 many years, all I used to do is lay awake nights and think. Stuff would run through my mind uncontrollably, as Bill said, and I would dwell on those things and run them back through my mind and never to get to a solution to them. But after this fifth step was over with, I began to look at the steps ahead, and I began to see that through those steps ahead that I could get those things squared away one time. I used to say, man, if I could always get this stuff squared up just one time, I'd be all right. And I didn't know how to do that. But the steps ahead are a way to square up all that stuff one more time, just one time. And I was looking forward then to moving on to the other steps.
Now, if you've done step 4 and 5, according to the Big Book, you've done a lot of work. You're probably tired. You probably need a little rest stop. Now, the Big Book's going to give us a little place to rest. He said, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. He doesn't say 72 days, does he? It's amazing. Every time he mentions time, he's talking about, let's get on with it right now.
You know why that is, basically? We've done step 3, and it's reduced just enough of our self-will to allow us to do this inventory process. And if we wait too long, that old self-will comes back, and we begin to think, the hell, I don't need to do this anyhow. That's why the time factor.
Carefully reviewing what we have done, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. We don't know Him yet, but we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals or steps, we ask if we've omitted anything, for we're building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? And here again, he's referring to this wonderfully effective spiritual structure that we're building. Step one, willingness was the foundation. Step two, believing was the cornerstone. And if we can answer these questions to our satisfaction, we then look at step six and seven. And we're going to look at them right after the break. Let's take a 15-minute break. We'll come back in here at 11:30. We'll be through by 1 o'clock. We told a story in the beginning about we alcoholics and the alcoholic's brain. I'd like to tell one more little story before we finish up, and this one is going to involve also an Al-Anon. And it seems as though the AA member, the Al-Anon member, and the Alateen member, they had been to an AA convention, and on the way home they decided to take a shortcut out through the country to see a little bit of the scenery. And sure enough, they got out in the countryside and they got lost. They were trying to find their way out, and they finally came to the old farmer's house. And they walked up to the door, and they knocked on the door, and the farmer came to the door, and they told him what the problem was. And the farmer said, well, he said, it'll be pretty easy for me to tell you how to get out of here. It's not that difficult. But he said, it's getting so close to dark that you're probably going to get lost again. He said, why don't you just spend the night here with us? Then you can get up and go home in the morning. And they said, oh, fine, that would be great. And the farmer said, I've only got one problem with it, though. One of you will have to sleep down in the barn with the animals. He said, I only got room to sleep two of you in the house. Little Alateen said, oh, let me sleep in the barn. He said, I love animals, and they love me, and everything will be great. So they all go to bed with the Alateen down in the barn. In about an hour, there's a knock on the door. Farmer goes to the door, and there stands the Alateen. The Alateen said, man, I can't sleep down there. He said, the pigs are grunting, the cows are mooing, the horses are stomping their feet, and the chickens are clucking, and I just can't sleep. But the alcoholic said, okay, come on in, go to bed. I'll go down in the barn, and I'll sleep with the animals. He said, hell, I was raised on a farm. Be no problem for me. So they all go to bed with the alcoholic down in the barn. Sure enough, in about an hour, knock on the door. Farmer goes to the door, and there stands the alcoholic. He said, man, I can't sleep down there either. He said, those pigs are grunting, the cows are mooing, the horses are stomping their feet, and the chickens are clucking, and I just can't sleep. The Al-Anon said, well, all right, come on in. I knew it would be up to me to handle the situation as usual. He said, you guys go to bed, and I'll go down in the barn, and I'll sleep with the animals. So they all go to bed with the Al-Anon in the barn, and sure enough, in about an hour, knock on the door. Farmer goes to the door, and there stands the pigs and the cows and the chickens.
Can't you just see, all right, you pigs, get over there, and you horses over there, and you cows over there.
Well, we're going to say one thing about Al-Anon. We love Al-Anon. I think it's the best thing that ever happened to AA. Without Al-Anon, there certainly wouldn't be any such thing as Barb and I living together. And everybody I work with, if they still got a spouse, we try to get that spouse at Al-Anon. You all can't make us drink, but you can sure as hell make us thirsty. When they get in Al-Anon, it just makes everything much better, period. I think it's a great, great thing. Okay, let's go now to page 76, top of the page. If we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step six. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can He now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. And you'll know that that's all of step six. And if you'll notice, He didn't say a word about defects of character.
He did so, though, so say those things which we have admitted are objectionable. Now, surely when we took step 4 and 5, and we looked out into that fifth column, and we saw that old selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate character that we had become, when we saw that those are the things that caused us to do the things to hurt others, and then they retaliated, and then we resented it, etc., then surely, surely that type of character has now become objectionable to us. Are we now ready to turn those things loose? If we are, we've already completed step 6. But the book recognizes that self cannot overcome self. And sometimes we're going to have God's help. Every one of these action steps has prayer in it. It says if we're not willing to let those things go, then we ask God to help us be willing. Now you would think, when we see what that type of character has done to us, we would be more than willing to turn it loose. But we human beings are funny things. Sometimes we would rather sit in today's pain and suffering because we've already learned how to handle it and take care of that to a certain extent. Some days we would rather sit in today's pain and suffering than take a chance on changing in the future, because we don't know what change is going to bring. And many of us, even though we recognize the need to turn these things loose, we're not quite ready to turn them loose. And I went to my sponsor and I said, I don't believe I'm going to be able to take 6 and 7. And he said, why? And I said, because if God removes all my defects of character, I'm not going to have any personality left at all. And he said, you're about 100% right. But he says, what you don't know is if God takes these things away, they're going to have to be replaced with something else. And he said, what replaces them will be so much better than anything you've ever had before, you'll wonder why it took you so long to get around to doing it. But he said, Charlie, you'll never know that unless you're willing to take the chance. So in step 6, with my sponsor's help and God's help, I became willing to turn loose of those things, and it was scary. You know, if you've been selfish all your life, and you're going to have to become unselfish, then how are you going to get what you want? If you've been dishonest all your life, you know nothing about honesty, period. How in the world are you going to make a living if you're going to have to be honest? If you've been self-seeking, frightened all your life, you don't understand what courage is. And you don't know how you're going to operate without that fear. If you've been inconsiderate of other human beings all your life, and now you're going to have to start considering other people first, then who's going to take care of you? Sometimes it's a very scary proposition. But when we are ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I'm now willing you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character. Whoop, we're in step 7 now. And step 7 said shortcomings, but here he says defects of character. You see what he's done to us? He's really fouled us up over a period of years until we figured this out. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character, shortcoming, personality trait, whatever you want to call it, which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We then completed step 7. Are you ready to let God remove those defects of character? If you are, you've taken step 6. Have you humbly asked Him to do so? If you have, you've taken step 7. But please don't make the mistake I did. I assumed that God, being all-powerful, He can do anything He wants to do. I assumed that when I'm ready, all I've got to do is turn to God and say, okay, God, here I am, warts and all, give me the $29.95 special, and He would zap me and make me as pure as the driven snow. No, I found out it doesn't work that way at all. I found out God will do for me what I can't do for myself.
But I found out he will not do for me what I can do for myself. I do not have the power to remove a defect of character. Only God has that power. But I tell you what I can do. Since he can't remove a defect of character and leave another hole in my head, I can find out the opposite of that defect of character, and with God's help and all the willpower I can muster, I can start practicing and trying to do the opposite of the defect of character. When I came to AA, my mind was a set of mental habits developed in 40 years of living by the time I got sober. The habitual thing for me was to be selfish. The habitual thing was to be dishonest. The habitual thing was to be self-seeking, frightened. The habitual thing was to be inconsiderate. Now, if you want to break a habit, the only way to do it is to work against yourself. If I want God to take away my selfishness, then in any situation that comes up, with God's help and all the willpower I can muster, I have to start trying to practice unselfishness in every case. And slowly, 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 the old habit dies, and a new habit takes its place. If I want God to take away my dishonesty, then I must force myself in every situation, with all the willpower I can muster and all the help I can get from God, to practice honesty. And slowly the old habit dies, and a new habit takes its place. If I want God to take away my self-seeking, frightened nature, then I must start practicing courage. I must kick myself in the rear and force myself with God's help to do those things I was afraid to do, and just as importantly, quit doing those things that I was afraid to quit. And the old habit dies, and a new one takes its place. If I want God to take away my inconsideration of other people, then I must start considering other people first. And I can't do that by myself. I've got to have God's help to do so. But slowly the old idea dies and a new one takes its place. I'm beginning to understand what the book says when it says, "We were reborn." I am not what I used to be. With God's help and many, many years of practice, I have changed from what I was when I came here to something entirely different. In a majority of the cases, not always, but in a majority of the cases today, I habitually react to a situation with unselfishness. In a majority of the cases today, I habitually react with honesty. In a majority of the cases today, I habitually react with courage. In a majority of the cases today, I consider other people first. Not always, but I usually do. I think I'm beginning to understand the book when it says, some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil. You can't stay selfish and become unselfish at the same time. You've got to turn it loose, and then you've got to practice the opposite. In effect, what we're really saying is we've got to work against ourselves. We can't keep doing the same things and expect to change at the same time. And with God's help and with all the willpower we can muster, we practice, we practice, we practice, we practice, and slowly, 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 we become a different human being. I think we're the luckiest people in the world. Most people in the world are sick. Most of them are going to the grave sick, not even knowing they're sick. We not only know we're sick, we know what's wrong with us. We found that out in steps 4 and 5. Through 6 and 7, with God's help, we can change those things. We have the opportunity to live 2 lifetimes in 1 lifetime. Very few people get that opportunity. Now be careful. Because if you buy into this idea that you, with God's help, can make these changes, then that means from this day on, you are responsible for what you are. Can't blame it on Barbara any longer. Can't blame it on Mother and Daddy any longer. Can't blame it on society anymore. Can't blame it on God. If I stay selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate, that must be because that's the way I want to be. I don't have to be that way any longer. And I am responsible now. Victimization has no place in AA. We can't blame it on others. From now on, it's our responsibility. Scary as hell, isn't it?
You know, there's always a paradox in AA. Everything is just exactly backwards from what you think it is, isn't it? If you look back. Well, the paradox here, and you know what a paradox is, to show you, how many of you ever called your sponsor so you could listen? That's a paradox. We always call so we can talk, right?
If you got a good sponsor, you end up listening.
Yeah. The paradox here is that they've used the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters to do steps one and two. 3.5 pages to do step three, 8 pages to do step four, 4 pages to do step five, and there's a whole chapter devoted to step seven, or chapter seven devoted to the 12th step. The two of the biggest steps in all of Alcoholics Anonymous is 2, 6, and 7 on two little paragraphs. That's the paradox. Two of the biggest steps. You know, by the time I got to this point, through 4 and 5, I could see what I had become. And boy, I did not like what I had become. And then I began to wonder, well, can God really change me? I mean, really? You know, I questioned that. Then I had to reaffirm a statement that I read earlier and said that God either is or isn't. What was my choice to be? Either he is everything or else he's nothing. And I had to say either he can do this or he can't. What was my choice going to be? So I chose to believe that God could. You know, these are the tools of change. The change from what I have become to what God intends for me to be. 6 and 7. The change from what I have become to what God intends for me to be. You know, there was another story in that other big, big book about this guy named Judas. Judas could not accept what he had become and what he had done. So he killed himself. We got people running around AA to say that, you know, acceptance is up front, acceptance, acceptance, acceptance. Well, acceptance is not an event. It's a process. And 6 and 7 is the process. The result is we have accepted what we have become, and it's okay. And there's another story in that book, too, that other big, big book. And this guy's name was Saul, S-A-U-L. And the story goes that he was riding his ass, one way I can say it. He was riding his ass on the way to Damascus. Right. Big bolt of lightning come down, knocks him off his ass on his ass, is the way I look at it. You know, he getting dusting himself off a little. That's what he said. And the big booming voice said, "Hey, Saul, can we talk?" Well, damn right we can talk.
Got his, you know, attention.
Got his attention, didn't it? Alcoholism kind of got our attention, too, didn't it? And he said, "Can we talk?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Saul, you've been a very resentful, angry individual, very fearful person, and because of that, you've harmed an awful lot of people, and I want you to quit doing that." And he said, "Well, how do you quit doing that?" He said, "Do these things. If you'll do these things, then you will change. And when you make the change, we'll call you Paul." And we all know that Paul was one of the greatest writers the world has ever known. And one time he was in a little town called Corinthians, and they asked him a question. And everybody wants to know the answer to this question. He said, "Paul, what is the secret to living?" Everybody wants to know that. And he said, "The secret to living is daily dying. The old Saul has to die so the new Paul can come alive." 6 and 7, two of the biggest steps in all of Alcoholics Anonymous, changes from what I have become to that which God intends for me to be. 6 and 7.
Okay, we've been making a lot of changes now. Through step four and step five, we got rid of those resentments. We got rid of those fears. We found our character defects. And through step 6 and 7, we've been doing something about the removal of those character defects. But there's still a part of my store up here that's filled with the damaged and unsalable goods called guilt and remorse. You know, I've looked at those things and I've looked at the cause of them, but I really haven't done anything about their removal yet. So if I want to be whole and complete, if I want my mind to be completely serene, happy, and free, it looks like I'm going to have to do something about emptying out that storeroom that's filled with guilt and remorse. So that also can be replaced with peace of mind, serenity, and happiness. And we all know, and the world has known it for thousands of years, that the way you get rid of guilt and remorse associated with things that you've done in the past is you make restitution for those things. Now, I don't know of anybody in AA that really loves to make restitution. You know, I've never seen anybody and come to an AA meeting for the first time, read the steps off the wall, and say, boy, that steps 8 and 9 looks like that's going to be fun. I can hardly wait until I get there. You know, nobody likes to ask forgiveness for things in the past. Nobody likes to take from today's living to pay back from things of the past. The only question is, can we afford not to do these things? And it seems as though if we don't do something about that guilt and remorse, that it's really going to keep blocking us off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And that stuff backs up in our mind, and the old character defects come right back to the surface, and we start having troubles with people, places, and things. We get blocked off from God, and we get drunk over it. It seems as though if we don't do something about that guilt and remorse, that it's really going to keep blocking us off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And that stuff backs up in our mind, and the old character defects come right back to the surface, and we start having troubles with people, places, and things. We get blocked off from God, and we get drunk over it. When we read the foreword to the second edition, it sounded like Dr. Bob never took another drink after Bill called on him. But that's really not true. Dr. Bob had one more drunk left in him after Bill made the initial visit. It wasn't too long after Bill made the initial visit that Dr. Bob decided he needed to go to a medical convention. And his wife Ann begged Bill not to let him go. Said if he goes over there, he'll get drunk. He does it every year. Bill said, let him go. If he gets drunk, that's okay. We'll do something about it when he gets back. He's got to learn to live in society where there's always going to be plenty of alcohol. Sure enough, Dr. Bob went to the medical convention, got drunk. Came back to Akron, shows up at his nurse's home. Nurse calls Ann and said, come and get him, he's drunk. And said, get him sober, he's got surgery scheduled in the morning. Said he's the only doctor on staff that can do this particular surgery at the present time. Dr. Bob was a proctologist. Now, I don't know what a procto is, but I'm glad he wasn't working on mine the next morning, whatever it is. They went over and they got him and they brought him home and they walked him and they coffeed him and they sobered him up to the best of their ability. The next morning, Bill takes him to the hospital to do the surgery. In the parking lot of the hospital, Dr. Bob said, Bill, I can't do this surgery. He said, I'm shaking, I'm trembling, I'm going to hurt somebody. And Bill said, you'll be okay. Reached in the back seat of the car, got out a bottle of beer, popped the top on it, said, drink this and it'll be all right. Dr. Bob drank the beer, went upstairs, did the surgery, and sure enough, it came out okay. And the only problem is Bill's waiting on him down in the parking lot. And Dr. Bob doesn't show up. A couple of hours later, Bill assumes that the beer's triggered the allergy. Bob's off and running. He goes back to Dr. Bob's house. Bill and Ann wait all day, all afternoon. Late evening, Dr. Bob shows up. And he's sober. And Bill said, where in the hell have you been? And he said, I've been going up and down both sides of the street, making my amends to those I've harmed in the past. That bottle of beer was the last drink that Dr. Bob ever took, June the 10th, 1935, which is AA's birthday. You see, always before, he would not make amends. He was afraid that people would find out he's alcoholic, and he would lose what little bit of his profession that he had left, his practice that he had left. He didn't know that everybody already knew it. The day he made his amends, mustered up the courage to do so, was the day he took his last drink. If it's good enough for Bob, it's probably good enough for me too. Let's look at steps 8 and 9 for just a few minutes.
Now, this steps 8 and 9 is some of the most best work I ever done in AA, but I'm like Charlie, I wasn't looking forward to doing it. But you see, I when I drank, I mean, I really got sick. You can't believe how sick I was. physically sick. I had thrown up something awful in my time. I had thrown up blood and chunks of stuff that I don't even know what it looks like. But I mean, I have been sick, sick, sick. But you know what? All that throwing up never caused me to want to quit drinking. I'll tell you what caused me to want to quit drinking was the guilt, shame, and remorse that I had as a harm I'd done to other people. That's the bottom line in all that. And steps 8 and 9 is a way that I can clear away the wreckage of my past. And it says now that we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. Now, generally, when we talk about steps 8, and it is a definite step, we end up talking about step 9, how we went about making amends. But step 8 is a definite step that needs to be worked, as the book said. We do step 8 first. He said, we have a list of all the persons we have harmed and to whom we're willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. So all we do is take all those names off of column 1 that we have harmed and put them on one long list. We haven't made any amends yet. We just took them off the list, put them on one long list, and then we become willing to the list. And if we're not willing, we simply ask God to help us to become willing. That's step 8, and it needs to be done in that manner. He said that we subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal, which is 4 and 5. Now we're about to go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. More prayer. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning that we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol.
Step 8 is a very simple step, a two-part step. We made a list of all those persons we've harmed, and we became willing to make amends to them all. If we're not willing to make amends to them all, we ask for help from God until we become willing to do so. Now, I tried a little trick on my sponsor in this area of step 8 and 9, because I remember going to him and saying, look, I don't believe I'm going to be able to do steps 8 and 9. And he said, well, why not? And I said, because I'm not willing to make amends to them all. Therefore, I can't do 8, and if I can't do 8, I can't do 9. He said, well, Charlie, now, step 8 don't say anything about making amends. You don't have to make amends till you get to 9. He said, why don't you want to make some amends? And I said, because some of those people have hurt me worse than I've ever hurt them. And I'll be damned if I'm going to make amends to them. He said, well, as usual, you get in the cart before the horse.
Blowing smoke.
He said, step nine deals with making amends, and step 8, you don't have to make any amends. You just got to be willing to. And I said, well, that's why I can't do them, because I'm not willing to make amends to them all. And if I can't do 8, then I certainly can't do 9. He said, well, maybe I can help you in that area. He said, I've seen your list. We've talked about it before. And he said, some of those people on your list, you would really like to make amends to them right now. He said, there's your children, there's your mother and father. And he said, now, I don't know about Barbara either, we'll deal with that later. But he said, some of them you'd like to make amends to right now, is that right? And I said, well, yeah, you know it is. He said, take them off of that list and put them on another sheet of paper and hit it right now. Can you do that with those names? And I said, well, yeah, I guess so. And he said, we'll do it and come back. And I did, and I come back, and I said, okay, here's the list. Now what I do? He said, some of the names on this original list, you know you're going to make amends to them. Sooner or later, you know you're going to do it. Is that right? And I said, yeah. He said, okay, take them off of that list, put them on another sheet of paper, and call it later. Can you do that? And I said, well, I guess so. He said, do it and come back, and I did. I said, here's the list. Now what I do? He said, some of these names on that original sheet you're not sure about. You may or may not make amends to them. Is that right? And I said, well, sure it is. He said, take them off that original sheet, put them on the third sheet of paper, and list them as maybes. Can you do that? And I said, I guess so. He said, do it and come back. And I did. He said, here's your list. Now what do I do? He said, all those that's left on this sheet, the original list, those are the ones you never intend to make amends to. Is that right? And I said, yeah. He said, take them off of there and put them on another sheet and call them nevers.
can you do that? And I said, well, I guess so. And he said, do it and come back. And I did. I said, here's the list. Now what do I do? He said, very simple. I want you to start making amends to the right nows. And he said, by the time you're through with it, you'll probably be ready to do some of the laters. He said, by the time you're through with the laters, I think you'll be ready to do these maybes. And he reached in his pocket and he got out a $20 bill. He said, I'm going to bet you $20. By the time you're through with the maybes, you'll be ready to start on the nevers list. And the old fool was just exactly right. He didn't let me take two or three names and block myself off from the whole process. He gave me a way to become willing to make amends to them all. And as I worked through the list, gradually, I got ready to do them all. And it really did work. If you got a problem in that area, or if you got anybody you're sponsoring got a problem, have them try the four lists and have them start with the right nows. And the thing really does work.
I think in this area of step nine, which we're going to talk about, we need our sponsors more than any other time, I think, or at least very important. Because sometimes you can go out and try to make amends to other people and do more harm in trying to make amends than you did when you just kept your mouth shut. Sometimes we need help from somebody, an objective individual, to show us how and why and when maybe we should do these amends. Because we can cause a lot of harm trying to make amends for things.
Okay, now step nine is a very definite multiple-part step. Three distinct parts in it. The first thing step nine does is tell us the kind of amends to make. We made direct amends. The second thing it does is tell us when to make them, wherever possible. Now, it sounds like whenever possible it will be better. And a lot of people, when they read that step, they read it whenever possible. But you tell an alcoholic to do something whenever, forget it. It's not going to be done. It says wherever possible. Then it tells us when not to make them, except when to do so would injure them or others. So on the next few pages, Bill very carefully addresses each one of these issues, paragraph by paragraph. First thing in step nine he talks about is direct amends. And we believe one kind of direct amends is eyeball to eyeball, face to face, one on one. The purpose of making these amends is not to get you to like me. Oh, I hope you will when I'm through. But the purpose is to get rid of my fear, my guilt, and my remorse associated with that thing. If I write you a letter, I'm never quite sure how you've received it. I'm still concerned about what you're going to do the next time I run into you. I'm not sure I've done my utmost. If I call you on the telephone, I've still got that same situation. But if I go find you wherever you are and sit down with you eyeball to eyeball and make my amends to you directly, I'll never have to be worried about it again. You will have done all you're going to do to me right then, and I will have done my utmost. He gives us an example on page 77, down in that paragraph in the middle of the page, and it starts, really, with the third sentence. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. This is an example of a direct eyeball-to-eyeball, one-on-one amend.
So the question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. It may be he has done us more harm than we've done him. And though we may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we're still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It's harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feelings and expressing our regret. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply, we tell him that we will never get over drink until we've done our utmost to straighten out the past. We're there to sweep off our side of the street, realize that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so. Never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are discussed. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. Getting tired. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, will we be gratified with the result? In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens.
Sometimes a man we're calling alone admits his own faults, so feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we're doing and wish us well. Occasionally they will offer assistance. It should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of his office. We have made our demonstration, done our part. It's water over the dam. Every time I read that, it reminds me of my cousin Gary. I was in a restaurant one day when I was in this area, the making amends. I've never been in that restaurant before or since. And I looked up at the door, and there stood Gary. And later on, I found out he had never been in that restaurant before or since. And I sometimes say, well, is that odd or is that God? You know, God makes the wherever possible a lot of times. And so I saw Gary, and I motioned him over. And he came over very reluctantly. He wasn't quite sure what I might do. Because Gary and I were just exactly alike. And every time we were around each other, we fought, we fussed, we physically fought or verbally abused each other in some way. So we kind of had a deal, we'd just stay away from each other. So Gary came on in reluctantly, and I asked him to sit down, and he did. And I told him, I said, Gary, I'm a joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm trying to straighten out my life, and I have harmed you many, many times over our lifetime, and would you forgive me? He kind of relaxed like that, and he said, you know, gentleman wants to ask you to forgive me for the things I've done to you. All that stuff just went away just like that. And then the best part about it is that because of that conversation, from time to time, Gary comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. And when he does come, he comes to the group I attend. And when he does come, we're able to share a little bit about this program as much as he will allow me. Now, Gary has become a, from a daily drinker, he's become a periodic drinker. But, you know, he's making progress. But without that conversation, we couldn't have had him coming to AA at all. This last year, late last year, Gary got a 25-year suspended sentence because of some of his activities. And he's not to associate with any known felons. He's not to be in any bars. He's not to disobey the law in any way. If he does, the deal is they're going to pick him up and take him directly to the prison. They're not even going to stop down to the courthouse. They're going direct down. Well, you know, I don't know if Gary can do 25 years of not drinking and not associating with felons. I couldn't stay sober 25 days. And I don't know if he's going to make it or not. But hopefully he will. I don't know.
Eyeball to eyeball, face to face, one on one, direct amends. No doubt it's the best way to do it. Okay, another thing that bothers us a lot, it seems as though we've hurt a lot of people also in a material way. And some of we alcoholics had a tendency to write hot checks we never did pick up, to borrow money we never did pay back, to tear up automobiles we never did fix. What are we going to do about that kind of stuff? And we also know that in order to get rid of that particular kind of guilt and remorse, we need to make equal restitution based on whatever it was. Bill handles that in the next paragraph. He says, most alcoholics owe money. Now, I think that's the understatement of the year right there. We do not dodge our creditors, tell them what we're trying to do. We make no bones about our drinking. They usually know it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, for we're liable to drink if we're afraid to face them. I think what he's telling me is this. I need to go to this guy that I owe the money to. And say, look, you and I both know that I owe you a couple thousand dollars. I don't have the money today to pay you. I'm sorry. I wish I could. But what I'd like to do is start paying you $5 a week or $10 a week, whatever I can pay you and still be able to live reasonably comfortably. What I would really like to do is wait till I get it all together in one lump sum. Put it in a sack and take it in there and slam it down on the desk and say, here's your damn money. But in a majority of the cases, we're not going to be able to do that. Now, we can go to them and arrange the best deal we can with them. and then start paying them that 5 or 10 or 15 a week, whatever we decided to do. And some morning we wake up and, by golly, that sucker's paid off. We don't have to feel guilty about that one anymore. We go to the next one. Say, you and I both know that I owe you about $1,500. I can't pay you today. I wish I could. But I'd like to start paying you $15, $20 a week. By now, I can probably pay a little more money. And someday I'll wake up and that one's paid off. Then I go to the next one, the next one, the next one, and the next one. And some morning I wake up and, by golly, they're all paid off. The fear, the guilt, the remorse associated with that, it's all gone. I'm not afraid of meeting you anywhere anymore because I don't owe you any more money anymore. You know, one of the greatest, greatest things in my life is to be able to walk down the street of the small town I live in and not be afraid of meeting anybody, period, because I've made my restitution to them. I don't owe anybody anything. I'm not afraid of meeting anybody. When I walk in my little bank, the head honcho of the bank, when he sees me come in, he smiles and he waves at me. Used to, he turned his head and went the other way. This is how you get rid of that kind of stuff. Now, I hear some of you saying, well, Charlie, that's probably right, and that's probably true for $1,500 or $2,000. But what if it's $50,000? What if it's $150,000? What if it's a half a million? Could we pay that back? Well, I don't know why we can't. If we're smart enough to steal it, we're probably smart enough to pay it back. You know, I think we forget from step 3 on, God's going to be with us. And if we're supposed to do these things, God's going to make it possible for us to do so. One of the greatest friends that Joe and I had in AA is a fellow named Dan. Dan's dead now. We would have been celebrating his 46
last January.
A birthday this year if Dan had lived. Dan was 29 years sober, and he said, Charlie, I paid the last one of them last week. I said, Dan, how do you feel? He said, I feel about 8 foot tall. Dan was a little bitty fellow, about 5 foot one. He said, this is the first time in my life that I can ever remember that I don't owe somebody something for what I've stolen in the past. He said, I feel pretty good about old Dan. When Dan was drinking, he was down in Texas in the oil business. And he hooked them, and he hooked them big, too. Took him 29 years to pay them back. But he got it done. Tell you how good a con artist Dan was. When he was down in Texas drinking, his wife, Sarah, who later became a beautiful Al-Anon, she decided to take Dan to the state insane asylum and have him committed for alcoholic insanity. The head psychiatrist interviewed Sarah, then he interviewed Dan, and after a while Dan left and Sarah was locked up. Yeah, she stayed there for a year. She learned how to live better electrically and all that good stuff, and Dan was a real con artist.
I spent the first 5 years of my sobriety basically in Dan's house and Sarah cooking, and my wife and I, and they've spent in giving us AA information because they loved AA, and I know they loved us. But Dan lived pretty dang good. He didn't suffer for anything. Lived in a nice house and drove a nice car and went wherever he wanted to go. So paying all that money back, it seemed to me like he always managed to come up with enough to do what he wanted to do. So he lived good. Didn't hurt him any.
See, God's with us on these things, and God's going to make it possible to do so if we're willing to do so. Page 79, and we're not going to go through all these because it takes too much time, but on 79, he talks about where other people are involved. We've got to be very careful in the making of these amends, that we don't harm the one that we owe the amends to even further, or just as importantly, we don't harm somebody else in the making of the amends. He emphasizes that over and over. On page 80, he talks about where we go get the permission of some people that might be harmed by this before we make the amends. On page 81, he talks about domestic problems. He talks about sex outside of marriage. What are we going to do about those kind of things? We find that almost invariably, The answers to questions about making amends can be found here in the Big Book. As to how to make them, should we make them or should we not make them? And I'm like Joe, I don't think this is an area we should even be attempting to do on ourselves. I don't think we can see the truth about these things to the extent that we really know whether it's going to hurt another person or not. I think this is where we really, really need our sponsors in order to help us determine, should we make the amend, should we not make the amend? A lot of them I wanted to make. He said, no, let's don't do that right now. Let's wait a while. Let's see if it won't be better to do this later on. A lot of them I felt I couldn't make because it might hurt somebody. He said, oh, no, no, no. You're just blowing smoke up your tail here. He said, it's not going to hurt a soul for you to go do this. Let's get it done. That's where we need some good advice.
Now, if you're going to make a financial amends, take some money with you.
It always helps.
It helps a little.
Page 83, third paragraph. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them. We can honestly say to ourselves that we'd write them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. There may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, and considerate, and humble, without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. Now, we do not have to beg people to forgive us. We go to them. We make our amends the best we can. And if they don't accept it, there's really not anything we can do about that, except hold ourselves in readiness to make it again later on if the possibility exists. We certainly don't have to crawl before anybody, Joe.
One more thought about this making amends. Phyllis was the queen bee of the Zebra Lounge when I met her. She run that place. And I was sitting there one night like this, drunk, and she was introduced to me. And she said, Joe, you know, you look like my third husband. And I said, my God, how many have you had? She said, two. Which I, you know, I kind of like that. So Phyllis, I've been watching her. She'd come to the bar after work, and she'd close the beer bar down. And, of course, in Oklahoma, we had to go to clubs after that, private club, so to speak, and drink drinks afterwards. And we'd stay there till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. We'd go down by the restaurant and have breakfast, and then we'd go back to work, pretty much. Rarely did we get any sleep. And I liked that, because I knew by this time I wanted a woman to drink. That other one didn't drink, and she was mean and ugly. And I wanted one that drank this time. So that's where I got Phyllis. Well, after we got married, as I told you, we just couldn't get along. I mean, at all. We're enforcing our list on each other, and it was nothing but hell. And we had a little deal, Phyllis and I. It was this. You go on that side of town and take care of that over there, and I'll go over here, and I won't bother you, and you don't bother me. Okay? And that was our deal. And we would meet at the house from time to time. Well, after a while, I got me a little mobile home up on Keystone Lake. They know where it is. Nice mobile home. Real nice mobile home. And Phyllis didn't know anything about this. I thought. But one night, there's a knock on the door about 3 o'clock, bang on the door about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I finally get up and I go, well, she just broke in is what she did. Our daughter Gail was with her. My girlfriend was there, embarrassed me in front of her. Terrible situation. I was not having a good time. Next morning, I got up and all my stuff laying out in the yard like it's supposed to be. Y'all know what I mean by stuff, don't you? Dirty T-shirts, dirty shorts, shirts and clothes that need to be ironed and washed. They never throw out anything clean. I don't know why that is. Took my car, went down to the bank, took what money we had, went to the lawyer's office, filed for divorce, and had it served on me. Boy, it made me mad. After all I'd done for her, her to do that. Well, sometime later, a year or so, I get sober. And then 2.5 years later, Phyllis got sober. And then 9 years later, I'm standing at the back of the room greeting people as they came in. And I turn around, and here's the lady of the mobile home incident coming in the door to her first AA meeting. I really wasn't having a good time. I looked over, and Phyllis was at the coffee pot, and she looked over her shoulder and saw this situation, and some of the guys kind of knew about this deal, and they said, Joe, what did Phyllis say?
I said, she didn't say anything for about a week. She was really hot. And we go to another AA meeting, and here's this lady and Phyllis and I, and on the way home from the meeting, she began to talk ugly to me. They'll do that, you know. And I began to pay the price again. And we go to another meeting, here's the lady, and she says some more smart things. Well, about 2 weeks later, when she finally settled down, we were able to talk about this that night. And I said, Phyllis, you know that I've already paid one hell of a price for that pill. Emotionally, spiritually, physically, and every other way you can pay. Financially. And I've told you when we got back together that I wouldn't do those things anymore, and you know that I haven't. And what I'm really trying to tell you, honey, is you got a problem with that lady, and I don't. And I suggest you get it straightened out, because I am not paying no more. You understand? They'll let you pay forever if you will pay. There comes a time when you quit paying. After all you can do, then you quit paying.
Okay, we've read in the book now that this thing is a design for living that really works. We also read way back in step four about us being tri-dimensional creatures. And we read about the fact we're spiritually ill, we're mentally ill, and we're physically ill. I didn't know what that meant for a long, long time. But I finally figured out we really are tri-dimensional creatures. If God dwells in each of us, that means we have to live with God whether we like it or not, it's beside the point. And it is, do we live with God in harmony or disharmony? I don't know of any group of people in the world that ever got in more disharmony with God than we alcoholics have. Also, we all have a mind, a mental dimension. Sometimes we act like we don't, but we do. And we're going to have to live with our mind whether we like it or not. The only question is, do we live there in harmony or disharmony? I don't know of any group of people in the world that ever got in more disharmony in their minds than we alcoholics have, sick mentally. We also have what we call the physical dimension. Now, for years, I thought that referred to my body only and referred to physical illnesses. But I realize today the physical dimension is the world and everything in it. And we don't have any place else to live except here on earth, whether we like it or not. I don't know of any group of people that ever got in more disharmony with the world and everybody in it than we alcoholics have. We were sick in the physical dimension. Now, it looks to us like these first nine steps are really designed to put us back together the way God intended for us to live in the first place. It looks like through steps 1, 2, and 3, we get right with God. Because of our powerlessness in step 1, we saw the need for the power in step 2, and step 3, we made a decision to go after that power. We made a decision to let God be the director. Now, for self-directed people, this is a great, great change to decide to let God be the director. And that's the first time we've had that relationship with God as far back as we can remember. So we begin to get right in the spiritual dimension through steps 1, 2, and 3. That removed enough self-will to let us start looking into our own minds. Through step 4 and 5, we found out what's wrong with us. We found those things that create our problems with God, other people, and etc. Through step 6 and 7, we begin to work on those things, and we begin to get right in the mental dimension through steps 4, 5, 6, and 7. That removed enough self-will to let us start reaching out to our fellow man. And through steps 8 and 9, we got right with the world and everybody in it. In other words, through the first 9 steps, we got well spiritually, mentally, and physically. Now, if you're right spiritually, mentally, and physically, you're probably going to feel pretty good. This is the first time we've been well in all 3 dimensions, probably throughout our entire lifetime. And if you're right with God, and you're right with yourself, and you're right with your fellow man, you're probably going to feel pretty good. I don't think it's by accident. The very next thing in the big book happens to be the promises. They come after these first nine steps. Let's read the promises real fast. See what we can expect to get from this.
Bottom page 83. See, we're painstaking about this phase of our development.
Which phase? Well, the amends phase.
We'll be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we've gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They're being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly.
Spiritual experience.
Sometimes slowly.
Spiritual awakening.
But they will always materialize if we work for them. You know, when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was restless, irritable, discontented, full of guilt, shame, and remorse as a result of things that I had done. And I began to apply these steps to my life, especially 8 and 9. I've taken care of all the amends that I need to know and that I know about. As a result, I have received these promises in my life. And they're not in my body. These are promises all happen in your mind, you see. And these are, if I look at those promises the way I look at them today, I have been reborn. Old ideas cast aside, new ones accepted. I am not what I used to be, thank God. And these things happen here.
I'm going to read them one more time. And I read them for two reasons. Number one is I love the way I read them. But the real reason is I'm going to add some words to them. And the words I'm going to add to them refers to a time when I was young. I could drink alcohol, be Fred Astaire on the dance floor, the greatest lover in the back seat of a 36 Chevrolet. This is the way alcohol used to make me feel before it turned against me and literally destroyed me. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I did not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would comprehend the word serenity and I would know peace. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, no matter how far down the scale I'd gone, I could see how my experience would benefit others. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity would disappear. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in my fellows. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, self-seeking would slip away. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, my whole attitude and outlook upon life would change. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, fear of people and economic insecurity would leave me. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would suddenly realize that alcohol was doing for me what I could not do for myself. Think about that for a minute. My God, no wonder I drank. When you find something that will do that for you, and it repeats it for you over and over and over and over and over, you immediately become obsessed with the idea of using it. Alcohol was my friend for a long, long time. Alcohol let me do those things that I could not do, left on my own strength unaided, and I loved it, and I loved what it did for me. But then one day, alcohol began to turn against me. All those things I was afraid that would happen now began to happen because of the alcohol itself. And I became a very, very confused individual. Not knowing I was alcoholic. Not knowing I would never be able to regain these things from alcohol. I spent the last 6 years of my drinking desperately trying to recapture these things, and alcohol almost destroyed me in the process. I came to AA and you handed me a book. And I took that book and I applied the first nine steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life to the best of my ability. And one day I woke up with a full realization
that these first nine steps through these promises have given me everything good that alcohol gave me when alcohol was my friend. That's why I don't drink today. If I hadn't have found it some other way, I would still be looking for it. I would probably have destroyed myself in the process, but you see, I don't need to drink today because the first nine steps have given me all the good things that alcohol ever gave me. With that realization, I also realized that so far, the first nine steps have never turned against me as alcohol did. I've never been placed in jail because of the first nine steps. No woman has ever drugged me through a divorce court because of the first nine steps. Nobody's ever beat the hell out of me because of the first nine steps. I've never vomited. Damn near did a time or two, but never really vomited because of the first nine steps. You see, that's the miracle. That's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. If we receive these things in our minds, compared to what we were when we got here, then surely we've undergone a radical change in our personality. Surely we've had a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening if we receive these promises in our minds. Now, if that's true, then what's the purpose of the last three steps? Many people will tell you the last three steps are maintenance steps. And we'll agree that the last three steps will help us stay sober. But the word maintenance itself is a misnomer. There's another law applies here that says everything in our universe is in a constant state of change. To maintain means to keep as is. You can't keep anything as is. We've made a tremendous amount of spiritual growth through the first nine steps, but if we tried to stop and maintain that, then we start slipping back. But the word maintenance itself is a misnomer. There's another law applies here that says everything in our universe is in a constant state of change. To maintain means to keep as is. You can't keep anything as is. We've made a tremendous amount of spiritual growth through the first nine steps, but if we tried to stop and maintain that, then we start slipping back. The next thing you know, we got trouble with people, then with God, and then with ourselves, and then we're drunk all over again. We believe the last three steps are growth steps, period. You know, twice Bill mentions in the book, once in his story and once in chapter 2, a fourth dimension of existence, a dimension that they never dreamed of. You can't describe it, you can't explain it, you can only feel it. And we believe the last three steps are designed to continue our growth until we move into an entirely new dimension of living. Let's look at them for just a few moments and then we'll be through. Let's look at step 10.
This thought brings us to step 10. Now, the one thing we did as a fellowship is we took all the steps out of this book and we put them on these little cards and we put them on the wall. I like them on the cards. I like them on the wall. The only problem with that is that a lot of people come into AA and they look at the steps on the wall and they try to take the steps off the wall without any instructions. You see, we left the instructions on how to work the steps in the book. And so they're not going to read the book, so they try to take them off the wall. So if you try to take step 10 off the wall, it would say this: continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. And somehow or another, we got the idea that if we do that at night in bed, that if we continue to take a little inventory, and if we were wrong, we promptly admit it, we'd be doing the intent of step 10. Well, step 10 is a lot more than that. Charlie and I have discussed this in great detail, and we don't get in trouble at night in bed much anymore. What we need is a daytime walking around step. So let's look at step 10 in a different light than that. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests that we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commenced this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the Spirit.
We've had a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening already.
Our next function is to grow.
To grow, not maintain, not where, stay where we are, but to grow.
In understanding and effectiveness. Now, this is not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear.
What step did we use to look at that in the first place? Anybody remember?
Four.
Step four, okay.
When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them.
What steps did we use there?
Six and seven,
okay.
We discuss them with someone immediately.
What step was that?
Five,
all right.
And to make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone.
And what steps did we use there?
Steps eight and nine.
Yeah.
Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code.
It looks to me like if we do step 10, the way the big book says to do it, we're going to be doing steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 every day for the rest of our lives. I defy anybody in this room to do steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 every day for the rest of your life and stay the way you are. You absolutely cannot do that. Also, we find that why wait until we go to bed at night to do that? If I get screwed up at 9 o'clock in the morning and I don't do something about it, then I'm going to waste another day in resentment and fear and so on and so forth. I don't want to waste any more time. What little time I've got left, I want to enjoy every minute of it. I finally have trained myself, and it took years to do this. I finally have trained myself that if I get screwed up at 9 o'clock in the morning, to stop, get over in the corner by myself, and I've got that inventory sheet right up here in my head. I can see it just as plain as day, and you can too. Okay, Charlie, who are you mad at? What did they do to you? What part of self has been threatened? What did you do, if anything, to set it in motion? Which character defect has come back to the surface? I can spot it immediately. I say, okay, God, you know I don't want to be this way. Take this selfishness away from me. Take this dishonesty, whatever character defect is involved. Discuss it with another human being as soon as I can, preferably my sponsor. Not always can I do it immediately, but I do when I can. Then I'll make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone. And that whole thing is gone in just a matter of minutes. If you continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, you're going to learn more about yourself. When these things crop up, if you ask God to take them away, they're going to become less and less and less. As you discuss them with another human being, you learn more and more and more about yourself. As you make amends quickly, if you've harmed anyone, your relationship with the world and everybody in it becomes better and better and better and better and better until we move into an entirely new dimension of living. A very, very valuable growth step. We've made a tremendous amount of spiritual growth. We've made a tremendous amount of growth in our relationship with the world and everybody in it. But we can't stop. We must continue, and the growth continues until we move into an entirely new dimension of living. After you've worked step 10 for a while, then you get an entirely new set of promises. We hear always about the promises on 83 and 84. We never hear about those on 84 and 85. Let's see what happens after step 10 for a while.
And he said, we cease fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time, sanity will have returned. Remember we said earlier that step one said that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. That was a problem. Step two was a solution. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, we get our sanity back over here on page 84, you see. For by this time, sanity will have returned. And once sanity has returned, let's look and see what happens. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we'll find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor had been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. Excuse me, that's the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We're neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react, so long as we keep in spiritual condition.
You know, remember way back on page 45 in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, when it said the main object of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Somewhere between page 45 and page 85, I found the power. The power reached in my mind and plucked out the obsession to drink. That's the real miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know me better than anybody in the world knows me. And if I still had to fight the desire to drink on a daily basis, I know exactly what I'd do. I'd go right back to it again. I always did before. But I don't have to fight it because God's removed it. Now, once again, He can't remove that and leave a hole in my head. I got enough of those already. If He removes the obsession to drink, it's got to be replaced. And the only thing that can replace it is the opposite. I think my mind is just as obsessed today with the idea of staying sober as it ever was with the idea of taking a drink. You see, an obsession in the mind is an idea that overcomes all ideas to the contrary. It can be strong enough, it can make you believe a lie. But also it can be strong enough that it'll make you believe the truth. The truth is, I can't successfully drink. And my mind is just as obsessed with that as it ever was with the idea of taking a drink. The real miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous.
So it's easy to let up on this spiritual program of action and left on our laurels. See, by this time, if you're lucky, you'll be back home, back in the house, sleeping on the couch. But if time, as time goes by, you may even get back in the bedroom. See, things could be real good.
Kids are speaking to you again.
Dog's not biting you when you come in. Wife's speaking to you. You might even have a couple of TVs you're making payments on. I was talking to my friend Gerard, and he's got his telephone back in less than a year. How about that? You know, that's real progress, isn't it? And then, you know, you got a couple of TVs, you get your telephone back. Things are going along pretty good. Maybe you've got a used car now. Things are good. Now, if we're not careful, these things that we're acquiring will compete for our sobriety. And things will get your sobriety. Because one day we look up and say, hey, I've got all these things. I need to work some more. I need to get a second job. I need to quit going to all those meetings. I need to quit doing these things. It's taking too much of my time. And those things will compete for your sobriety. It's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. He said we're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We're not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition.
Now, there's the word maintenance. One day at a time. You can't maintain forever, but we can do our best to maintain one day at a time.
So every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It's the proper use of the will. See, we've been saying all weekend that willpower is of no use. But see, God never gave us anything that was bad. It's only how we use it or misuse it that determines what's bad or good. He gave us willpower for a reason. And the reason is that we can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It's the proper use of the will. Thy will, not mine, be done. See, once you get your sanity back on page 84, now that you're sane, now you know what to do with your willpower, which you get back on page 85.
Notice the perfect sequence of the book. It'd be hell to get our willpower back before we got our sanity back, wouldn't it?
For sure.
Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction, not suggestion, from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we've carefully followed directions, not suggestions, we've begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. To some extent, we become God-conscious. We've begun to develop this vital sixth sense. Now, we must go further, and that means more action.
Listen to the commentary on this one paragraph, please.
We're now beginning to talk about a sense of direction called a sixth sense of direction. You know, everything I know on a conscious level, I've learned through five senses of direction. I can see, and I can smell, and I can taste, and I can hear, and I can touch. And everything I've learned on a conscious level, I've learned on those five senses of direction. But you can take everything I know, and everything all of you guys know, and everything every human being knows, and add it together, and it's just a tiny, tiny speck of knowledge compared to the knowledge of the universe. Now, if God has all knowledge and all power, and I believe He does, my book says so, if God dwells in each of us, and I believe He does, my book says so, that means you and I have within inside ourselves all the knowledge and all the power that we can ever need to handle any conceivable situation which might come up in the future, providing we know how to tap into that knowledge and that power. And that's always been referred to as a sixth sense of direction. And it's long been known how you tap into it. You tap into it through prayer and meditation. This is nothing new. And most of us, when we get here, we're completely bankrupt in those areas. I know I was. I knew nothing about meditation. Oh, I had heard that it was perhaps clearing your mind of all thought. I've never been able to clear my mind of all thought. When I get up in the morning, that sucker turns on, it runs all day long. I've never been able to shut it down. I thought maybe it was lying down and listening to soft music, or perhaps it was chanting certain words. Those are probably forms of meditation. I knew nothing about them at all, period. I knew very little about prayer. Even being raised in church, I knew very little about prayer. I had two prayers that I used in my lifetime. One went like this. Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I die, but I'm not interested in that prayer anymore. It's dealing with death. I'm not interested in that. The other prayer I used, and I'll bet you used it too, went like this. God, if you'll get me out of this damn mess, I swear I'll never do this again. Now I'm going to have to develop a life of prayer and meditation in order to be able to tap into this sixth sense of direction. It would seem to be an impossible thing. You know, thank God Bill Wilson was a real alcoholic. Thank God that he had the same problems that I had. Thank God Bill Wilson didn't know very much about prayer and meditation. You know, most people that really are really knowledgeable in this area, when they write completely over my head, and I can't understand them. Bill couldn't do that. What he did do on the next 2.5 pages is give us a series of suggestions that if we will follow them in our own lives, each one of us individually will develop our own life of prayer and meditation. A way to tap into that unsuspected inner resource of strength that we call God, or God as we understand it. On page 85, first paragraph, he's going to tell us what to do when we go to bed at night. 86, excuse me. Then he's going to tell us what to do when we get up in the morning. Then he's going to tell us what to do when we face indecision. Then he's going to tell us how to pray. And then at the bottom of page 87, he's going to tell us what to do when agitated or doubtful. And if we follow these little suggestions, we'll develop our own life of prayer and meditation. Very briefly, let's look at the first paragraph on page 86.
It said, when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid?
There's step 4 again right there.
Do we owe an apology?
There's step 8 and 9 again.
Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once?
There's step 5 again.
Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time, or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into this realm of life? but we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken.
And there's step 6 and 7 again. Mm-hmm. So really, he's suggesting at nighttime we do 4, 5, 6, and 7 over again. We made up a little inventory sheet that you might want to use or something similar to it, which kind of deals with what we've been talking about. On that little inventory sheet on the left-hand side of it, we put the personality characteristics of a self-willed human being. On the right-hand side of the sheet, we put the personality characteristics of a God-willed human being. Tried to find the opposite and put it on the right-hand side. Now, all we're trying to do is get from the left-hand side of the sheet to the right-hand side of the sheet. It only takes a few minutes at night to run down through there and make some check marks and see where we've been that day. Never yet have I found myself completely on either side of the sheet. I also find that as I do this over and over and over, the locations of the check marks change, but I find that I'm beginning to check more on the right-hand side than I am on the left-hand side of the sheet. A way that we can continue this change in our personality for the rest of our lives. Now, what I have learned in my time in AA is I am going to inventory. I am going to inventory. I really don't have any choice in the matter. The only choice I have is to wait until I'm so sick that I'm almost drunk, start trying to dig myself out from under that mess, or I can inventory on a daily basis and keep myself in fit spiritual condition. I am going to do one of the two, and I find that it takes less energy to do it on a daily basis than it does to wait until I'm almost drunk and then start trying to dig out from under it, with much less chance of ending up drunk over these things. There's a fellow named Carl Sandburg. And Carl Sandburg said, when a society fails, there's always one thing present, and that is they forgot where they came from. And if they forgot where they came from, they forget where they're going. And they get lost out there some way. The only way you and I will fail is if we forget where we came from. And if we do, we'll forget where we're going, and we'll get lost out there too. If you inventory on a daily basis, you're continually reminded of the things that we need to continue working on. We're continually reminded of where we're trying to go, and we don't get lost out there somewhere. A definite, valuable suggestion. 5, 10 minutes at night, we'll do this. It doesn't take hardly any time to do it. Now let's look at what we do when we get up in the morning.
So on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. If we use that 10 minutes at night, then we've still yet got 23 hours and 50 minutes we can screw up. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that we be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we employ our mental faculties with assurance. For after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed up on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives.
On awakening, it doesn't say wait until we get up and have breakfast. It says on awakening, as soon as we wake up, let's make this little contact with God. You know what most of us do on awakening? We jump up and we run to the bathroom first. You know, I had a guy tell me the first thing he did was get on his treadmill. I said, man, you got a better bladder than I do. I go to the bathroom first. After we relieve ourselves in a bathroom, then we normally head for the kitchen. We get a cup of coffee, we get a little food, and we feed the body. As soon as we feed the body, we run back into the bathroom. You ladies start fixing your face and your hair. We men do our shaving and whatever it is we do.
Fix our hair if we got any.
Fix our hair if we got any to fix. And as soon as we get our head straightened up on the exterior, then we go to the closet. And we start picking out the clothes that we're going to use to cover the body with
that day.
To make sure they match.
Spend lots and lots of time on picking out our clothes. They got to be the right style, the right shape, the right color, the right everything. After we close the body, we get ready to leave the house. We feed the dog or the cat, whatever we might have there. As we go out the door, we be sure and lock it. We don't want anybody to steal our junk while we're gone. We go out to the car. We walk around it. We check the air and the tires. We get in it. We turn the switch on. We check the fuel level. We did all of those things to handle the body and our material well-being. But what did we do about our mind? The mind's going to run the whole show all day long. Did we take just a few seconds to check the oil level, to check the fuel level, to check the air in the mind? You know, if we would spend as much time on our minds as we do on our bodies, hell, there would be no limit to what we could become. A very definite, valuable suggestion. Just a few minutes when we first wake up, make a little contact with God, asking God for the right thoughts and the right directions and etc. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, intuitive thought, or a decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We're often surprised how the right answers come after we've tried this for a while. This is meditation for busy, busy, busy people. We don't have time to sit down and listen to soft music. We don't have time to sit around chanting words. Hell, we're busy people. And the book says when we face indecision, let's stop for just a moment. Let's ask God for the right thought, the right action. Then let's relax and take it easy. And I don't think he means lay down. I think he means let's get our subject off of that matter so God can give us some information. As long as we're struggling with it, God can't get in there. Now, how do I get my mind off of that subject? Well, I go start doing something else. I go over here and paint the house. I go mow the grass. I start washing the dishes. I start doing something worthwhile. I can't do anything worthwhile when I'm struggling with this thing. And I'll get my mind off of that subject, on to another subject, and it's amazing. An hour later, a day later, information comes in my mind I didn't have before. It says, why don't you call Joe and see what Joe thinks about that deal? Now, I didn't think about that before. I called Joe and I asked Joe, and hell, he's got the answer just like that. And used to, I said, my, wasn't it lucky I thought about calling Joe. This is a form of meditation, receiving God's knowledge in our lives for us. It's amazing where the answers come from. Today I have finally learned that God is not going to speak to me direct. He doesn't speak to me direct. What he does is he speaks to me through other people. I have finally learned to listen to other people. Used to, when you were talking, I couldn't hear what you're saying because I'm so busy thinking about what I'm going to say. Just as soon as you shut up, I don't hear you. I've quit doing that anymore. And it's amazing where the answers come from. Sometimes I'm standing in a supermarket checkout line. Two little ladies standing up here in front of me talking. And damned if they're not talking about what I was struggling with yesterday. And they've got the answer for it. It's amazing how this thing works. A form of meditation for busy, busy people. Page 87, first paragraph, tells us how to pray.
So what used to be a hunch or occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. All these steps gradually become a working part of the mind. Being still and experienced and having just made conscious contact with God is not probably going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption with all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. You know, communication is the beginning of all understanding. Communication is the beginning of all understanding. Friday night, you guys didn't know us real well. We've been communicating. We've been talking. You've been listening at break and around the dinner table and whatever. You've been talking, we've been listening back and forth. So we know each other real well by now, pretty well. Well, wouldn't that work with God? Talking and listening to God, prayer and meditation, communication is the beginning of all understanding. He'll know us better and we'll know him better. We'll come to rely upon that, which I have. I was driving along one day, listening to the radio, and I don't know how I got on that particular station, but there was a song, and it was called In the Garden. And it just came to me. I heard that song all my life, and I didn't know what it meant. Y'all know what it did? In the garden, to come to the garden alone in the morning when the dew's on the roses. Well, that's the song of prayer and meditation. I didn't know that. Heard it all my life. Came to me. See, we usually conclude the period of a meditation with a prayer, that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will, and we're careful to make no requests for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that. It doesn't work. You can easily see why. As I said earlier, I used to say, God, give me this, God, give me that. If it's something I forgot to ask you for, please give me that also. You can see how that wouldn't work. So today I pray only for the knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry that out.
They came to me and they said, pray only for knowledge of his will and the power to carry that out. I said, how in the hell is he going to know what I want? And they said, he's really not interested in what you want. They said, he's interested in what you need. And they said, he knows more about what you need than you know yourself. Your life to get all you want. And you almost destroyed yourself in the process. They said, all you really need is knowledge of God's will for you and the power to carry that out. If I'd have made a list when I first came to AA, if I'd have said, God, these are the things I want. If you'll give them to me, I'll never ask you for anything else. I would have cheated myself. He's given me so much more than I ever dreamed possible that I would have cheated myself making that list. God knows what we need. We don't know what we need. Hell, we destroyed ourselves trying to get those things we thought we needed and what we wanted. God knows more about it than we do.
If our circumstances weren't, we ask our wives about it. 10 or 11 years into our sobriety, one morning I'm sitting over here reading my material, and Phyllis is sitting over there reading her material, and she handed me her book and said, honey, and I said, well, what's this going to cost? You know how they are. Honey, she said, no, you old silly thing. I said, what I want you to do is to read this to me and tell me what it says. Well, I can do that, you know. So I read it to her, and I explained it to her a lot more than she wanted to know. And the next morning she said, honey, would you read this and tell me what that says? And I said, sure. We did that. We talked about it a little bit, thought about it a little bit, and went off to work. Well, that kind of created a little thing in our family. We pray and meditate together. She started it. I didn't. You see, you got girls that have to help us with those things because we don't think about those things. But she did, and that has began a practice in our house. And the result of that is that we've been married now for 23 years. People that pray together stay together, I've always heard. And that's true.
23 years since you divorced old Phyllis.
Yeah. Okay. I call her my current wife. Keep her on her toes.
Okay, one more little valuable suggestion at the bottom of page 87. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show. Humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, thy will be done. Now here's the results of step 11. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily. But we're not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we're trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. And here's the shortest full paragraph in a big book. It works. It really does. That's a paragraph within itself. We alcoholics are undisciplined. So we let God discipline us the simple way we just outlined. Anybody that will follow these definite and valuable suggestions
will develop a life of prayer and meditation where we can begin to receive and do God's will. Each one of us individually can do so. He said, but this is not all. There's action, more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. We're not going to try to go through the next chapter. Let's talk just a little bit about step 12. A very definite multiple-part step. Three distinct parts in it. First part of step 12 is probably the greatest promise to be found anywhere in the big book. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. I think that promises to me that if I apply the first 11 steps to the best of my ability, I'm assured I'm going to have a spiritual awakening. What is a spiritual awakening? A personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. Bill tells us in the 12 and 12, there's many kinds of spiritual awakenings, as there are people in AA, but they've all got certain things in common. That is, we're able to feel, believe, and do things we could never do before on our own strength unaided. I feel things I've never felt before. I feel love, patience, tolerance, compassion, and goodwill toward my fellow man. Before AA, I could have cared less about you. Oh yeah, you could have some, but only after I extracted everything I wanted first. I don't feel that way anymore. I believe things I've never believed before. I believe God is a kind and a loving God. I believe He stands ready to help any human being anywhere on earth the instant they're ready to give up on self-will and turn back to Him. When I came here, I thought He was a God of justice, hell, fire, and brimstone. Today, I think He's pure mercy and pure love. My feelings have changed entirely in that area. I can do things I never could do before. By golly, I can stay sober. Hell, I never could do that before. Because of that sobriety, I'm allowed to do many, many things, go many, many places, see many, many things, meet many, many people that I never could do before when I was drinking. The last 6 years of my drinking, I became a recluse. I didn't want to see anybody. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't want to see nothing. All I wanted to do was drink and pass out. Certainly I can do things I never could do before. But it's true, you don't get something for nothing. Those of us that have received this spiritual awakening, we're now charged with a responsibility. And the responsibility is to carry this message, not a message, not the message, this message, to other alcoholics. What is this message? It's very simple. It goes like this. If you've been doing a little drinking, or if you're screwed up in life and you've been thinking about doing a little drinking, if you're sober and you don't feel good, we know exactly where you're coming from. That's where we came from. We came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We picked up a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. We applied the first 11 steps in our lives to the best of our ability. We've had a spiritual awakening, and we don't feel that way anymore. And if you don't want to feel that way anymore, then you do what we did. You apply the first 11 steps, let us help you as you do so, and you'll have a spiritual awakening, and you're not going to feel that way anymore either. That's the only message that Alcoholics Anonymous has got. Now, some of us fancy ourselves as healers. Some of us fancy ourselves as marital advisors, spiritual advisors, economic. Hell, I don't know of anybody that ever screwed that up worse than we did. No, no. We just know one thing. You and I are the experts in the field of alcoholism. We know more about it than anybody alive. We're the only people that's ever experienced it. We know more about recovery from alcoholism than anybody alive. We're the only people that's ever done it. You know, as I look at our whole history for AA, it's obvious that God got tired of seeing people like us die back in the 1930s. It's obvious that God took Bill and Bob, the first 100, Dr. Silkworth, Dr. Jung, the whole bunch, and put it together so we would have it today. He's always worked with people through people. Now, if that's true, then all of those people are dead today. Not a one of them left alive. If he picked people then surely he's picking them today. There's not an alcoholic in this room that ought to be here. Every one of us ought to be dead. Some of us two or three or four times. We used to say, my, wasn't we lucky last night? Luck didn't have anything to do with it. God let you suffer your alcoholism so you would know what he wants you to know. And when he got ready to use you, he removed the obsession to drink, period. So the only question in my mind today is, are we really going to do God's will? You know, God's will for us is to help other alcoholics. He's fed us with very, very unique knowledge to help a very unique group of people. He's given us the opportunity to avert death in countless thousands and thousands of people. All we got to do is show up, suit up, and be there ready to help when we can. I don't know if very many people that have those opportunities that we have. The final thing I have to do is try to practice these principles in all my affairs. What are the principles? Well, I think it's obvious they are the steps. He didn't want to use the word steps twice in step 12, so he used the word principles. In the foreword to the 12 and 12, he says the 12 steps are a set of principles, spiritual in nature. In how it works, he says, do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. The principle we have set down are guides to progress. What did he set down just before that statement? The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's easy for me to practice them in AA. I love you and I hope you love me, and we're going to do our best not to hurt each other. But I'm only in AA an hour or two a day. What do I do out there? Can I practice these principles, these steps in my home with my spouse? Can I realize how powerless I really am over that lady? Can I realize the insanity of trying to control her, knowing full well I can't? Can I make a decision and turn her will and her life over to the care of God as I understand him? Can I inventory me and find those character defects that keep me trying to control her? Can I talk about that to another human being? Can I become willing to have God take those away and ask him to do so? Can I make amends to her quickly when I've harmed her? There's times I'm ashamed of me. There's times I treat absolute strangers on the street with more courtesy than I treat my own wife in my own home. Just think, if I practice these principles there with her and she with me, well, we might pick up 10, 12, 14 hours a day where we could be peaceful, happy, and free with each other. If we don't practice them, we don't stand a chance. We're at each other's throat continually. We have no good times together at all. Can I practice them with my children? If I could, what little time I have left with my children, those are good times. If I don't, I try to control, they resist, we have no good times at all. Can I practice them on a job with my coworkers? Well, hell, if I could, I might pick up 8-10 hours a day there where I could be peaceful, happy, and free. You know, aren't we really saying that you and I have the tools through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that we can be peaceful, happy, free, and serene 24 hours a day, 365 days a year if we wish to? I think we're the luckiest people in the world. I don't know anybody in the world that has the opportunities that we have if we'll practice these principles in all our affairs. And make no mistake, God's not going to do this for you. Other people are not going to do this for you. But you can, with God's help and the help of other people, do it for yourself. I think we're the luckiest people on earth. Let's go to page 164, last two paragraphs, and then we're through.
You know, where did all this stuff come from? It comes from the best of religion, psychology, and medicine. And in another big, big book, there's a story there. It says this guy was at the meeting that night, and he said, the things that I do, he said, you can do also, and even greater. Well, a couple of guys heard him say that, They went back home and got this sick friend of theirs and brought him to the meeting the next night. And I like to think they were alcoholics because the room was full, standing room only. And the reason I think they were alcoholics is because they went up on the roof and they chopped a hole in the roof. And they left this guy down in there. And he looked down at that guy and he looked up at them and he said, well, it's by your faith that this man is healed. Isn't it by the faith of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous when I got here, as sick as I was, it's by their faith in this program that ultimately I was healed? Later on, he was in a little town called Cernan, and he was leading the meeting that night. He was talking that night. And after the meeting, they were drinking a little coffee and smoking a few cigarettes, drinking a little wine, I guess.
A little wine.
Little wine. But someone told him about a fellow they had locked up on the side of the hill in a cave. And he said, well, I want to go up and see that guy. I said, man, you can't go up there. This guy's bad. He's resentful and angry. He's harmed an awful lot of people. We've got him chained to the walls up there so we can protect him from himself and other people.
What's his name?
Yeah. He said, what's his name? He said, well, his name is Legions, for he is many. Many defects of character, you see. And he said, well, I want to go up there and talk to that guy. So he went up there and talked to old Legions, cut loose his chains of resentment and anger, set him free, just like he's done us. And he wrote a little step for us right here. All the other 12 people that he helped, he took them with him. And Legion said to him, said, can I go with you and do what you do? And he said, no, Legion. He said, what I want you to do is to stay here and to tell other people what happened to you. He said, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who's still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right. And this relationship is the only relationship this book really talks about. And great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God.
We did that in steps 1, 2, and 3.
Admit your faults to him and to your fellows.
We did it in 4, 5, 6, and 7.
Clear away the wreckage of your past.
We did that in 8 and 9.
Give freely what you find and join us.
We'll do that in 10, 11, and 12.
And we shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for letting us be here. We love you.
We're going to close with the Lord's Prayer, but before we do that, we want to really thank Joe and Charlie for what they've done for us this weekend. And also we want to thank our grateful host here and all the workers that were here. So can we give them all a round of applause? Yeah. And those that haven't picked up their certificates, they're out front. And the tapes will be available shortly, as soon as they get done with them. And it's time for lunch. So if you would all join us, we'll close in the Lord's Prayer. Whose Father?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever. Amen.
By the way, Jane is going to lead us in Amazing Grace.
Please feel free to join in for Amazing Grace. Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. How precious did that grace appear the hour I first believed. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Tis grace hath brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see.
Great, great, great.